Nowadays, YouTube is really, really difficult. It's very hard to stand out.
There's the creative mind, the more business mind. You're kind of one of those good at both people.
Whenever you give me a task, it has to be done amazingly.
What's your strategy for retention in videos?
If you just trust us, we'll make you the best video. It will do the most views it can. If you get in the way of the content strategy, you'll kill the video. People are not going to be satisfied when they see that video.
There are so many football creators out there. Why were you sure, like, oh, this is the guy?
We work together so expertly well. He's incredible at what he does. He's amazing. I'm absolutely happy operating in the shadows.
Let's talk about subscribers for a second.
Maybe 2-3 years, 10 million subs.
2-3 years, 10 million. You heard it here first, folks. Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. Today's guest is Alex Emery. He spent 8 years working as a digital producer for Sky Sports, the British broadcasting outfit, before leaving 2 summers ago to found Click, an agency dedicated to growing creators and brands. He and his agency are perhaps best known for growing football YouTuber John Nellis from 5,000 YouTube followers a year or two ago to now 1.7 million. But first, you were at Sky for 8 years, from since you were in university until you left. Why was it time to leave? I guess 8 years is a long time, right?
Yeah, so I actually didn't even go to university. I was just left straight from sixth form college. I would have been 18, not sure what that's called in the US, but straight into work as an apprentice at Sky Sports. So I kind of went right in at the deep end, didn't really do the whole like going to university, having fun, just straight Smart. Into work. But it was kind of doing exactly what I wanted to do. So I was like super, super excited to kind of get going and happy to kind of forego that kind of like gap year stage of the life and just get straight stuck into it, because I've always been like really, I just love hard work essentially, mm-hmm. because it's in something I do. The second you ask me to do any sort of like life admin, I cannot do it. But this kind of job that I've got, that I've carved out for myself, is just fun, right? Yeah. And every day it's
allows
really,
you to
really
never
fun.
Stop.
So
working.
I get excited to go to work. Exactly, right? And I'm switched on all the time. And there's dad's eyes, of course. But no, I was at Sky for 8 years, loved it. And kind of quite quickly transitioned into helping them with their YouTube channels.
Yeah.
And we kind of launched their YouTube channels after 2 years.
This was like 2015, right, that you joined?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And then I think in like 2017, I was kind of hired to be on this team of like six people to start YouTube for Sky Sports. And it was like this tiny little team, and we all had basically no idea what we were doing, mm-hmm. and all just blagging it on the job. We came from like a video background, but mainly doing kind of like cut downs and highlights for the website, not like YouTube content as we know it today.
Yeah, not
so
native.
Yeah, we kind of went in at the deep end and just learned, and it was a fantastic learning ground. And I still work with a lot of the people I started working with today, which is great.
That makes sense. Quick thing about, I guess, like work culture in the UK. So when I saw that you did the apprenticeship program, is that like an internship? Because I feel like when I think of apprenticeships, I think of like crafts and trades, right? Plumbers, electricians, roofers, glass blowing, like work with your hands type of stuff. Whereas like, you know, something like going to be a producer at a broadcaster, that's like an internship. Is that just a thing in the UK?
I'm not sure in terms of like the definition. We do have internships, but for an apprenticeship for me, it was very much like, let's do a year where I'm just basically a hindrance to everyone. And I'm just going to learn from everyone and just soak it all up. And you're going to pay me a very nominal fee.
Did you have video background before?
I did, but I was like 17. So it was kind of just like home video, shooting a bit of stuff and editing on Prem Pro, really, really basically. And kind of everything I know today has been learned from just teaching myself and soaking up knowledge from people around me who are very, very talented. And that's something I've always tried to do, really, is like, who's the smartest person in the room? Who's the best at Photoshop? Who's the best at editing? And just go and sit with them and learn. Because ultimately, if you do that, you can kind of steal a little bit from everyone. And you can kind of become this like jack of all trades, really, where you have a little bit of knowledge in everything. And then you go away and you practice and you learn and you teach yourself and you look to improve all the time. And ultimately, that's how you get to kind of further yourself and develop, right?
Yeah. So like 3 years or so into your time at Sky, I was looking at the Click website where you've got this great timeline. It says that in June of 2018, You took on a leading role at Sky Sports Football YouTube, and it reached 1 million subscribers in less than a year, having taken 3 years to reach 250,000 before you were in that role. Was there somebody in a leading role before there? Like, what did you come in and change? Why, like, how were you able to accelerate it and, like, you know, triple that growth?
Yeah, so basically there was no one really kind of taking real ownership for that channel. And as someone who's always loved football, it was very much like, please give me the reins for this. But I was really young. I'm trying to think dates. What date? I can't remember the dates.
2018. You're probably 2018. 20, right?
Yeah, I'm 29. So now, so 6 years back, so I would have been 23. Okay. I'm young. I'm probably on paper not ready to kind of take on that side of role. But kind of took on the responsibility. And whenever you kind of give me a task and you say it's mine, it has to be done amazingly, because it's like, this, I'm putting my name to this.
Yeah.
I really want to be able to like shout from the rooftops and say like, this was my thing and look how it did. So yeah, but I kind of, because I was YouTube centric as a 23-year-old and had always loved and always loved YouTube, I kind of came at it with that standpoint. Whereas I think previously it was almost being treated a bit more like a clips channel in a traditional like old school media. So I'd always, in that year, essentially take clips from a range of Sky Sports content and work out how to package them with a fantastic title, fantastic thumbnail, and make what would be a show, which you otherwise would never consume because it's an hour long, turn into maybe like 4 to 5 really digestible bite-sized clips that are packaged in a way that you have to click them, you have to watch them. And I think taking that approach basically just utilized what Sky Sports was doing. Like, ultimately, there's Sky Sports is this huge corporation where there's a ton of people making great content, but I was just a case of like, okay, let's utilize this. Let's take that clip from that show and let's turn it into this piece of content. Let's cut down this and turn it into this. So I was essentially, packaging stuff really well, getting it turned out fast, and just utilizing the amazing talent that Sky has, because ultimately you have talent like Gary Neville, Roy Keane. They're huge names. There's so much interest in what they have to say. So it's a case of, if you can package it successfully, then you're onto a winner, really.
Yeah, there's no need to like put lipstick on a pig. You're working with gold.
Yeah.
Okay, so
exactly.
You left after 8 years, and I understand basically this guy John, who you knew in some capacity before, John Nellis, he called you up. He'd been starting to do YouTube. He had like 5,000 subscribers, and he's like, hey, you know this kind of work. Like, do you know anybody who'd be willing to come and work with me and try to grow? And you're like, you know what? Like, fuck it. I will. And then you quit your job. Why was it the right time to quit? Why leave?
Few reasons, really. So like, there was a restructure at Sky, and our team did the YouTube stuff was, and I don't mind saying it, we had some real, real success. And it was a case of like, okay, do that, but do that across Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all that kind of, use that knowledge and kind of take on these other platforms. But in doing so, we became quite stretched and we had to cover multiple sports.
Well, because I mean, you're saying like the people above you didn't really understand these are different skills, different things, completely.
Yeah, and whilst it was, okay, there's a lot of transferable skills, equally, it's like, I don't specifically want to be working on like Twitter and covering cricket, which I don't like. Yeah. So essentially what was my dream job quite quickly disappeared and turned into a different role. And I was very much in the mindset that, okay, I'm young. I was, 27?
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, is there a better opportunity in life when you're in a position you don't really love your job anymore, and then an exciting opportunity presents itself and you back yourself? It was just the right kind of time. And with John, we'd kind of been doing a little bit on the side, outside of like working hours for each of us, and building up some revenue as like a side hustle. And I would always encourage people to do this, because I think like it sounds, if you just take the headline, like quits his dream job and jumps in and does, it's like, don't do that, please. Don't let me be the person to tell you to do that, because being self-employed is incredibly difficult, and anyone who tells you otherwise is lying. But if you can build up some sort of kind of buffer so that you can, when you jump, it's not like you're jumping from your dream job into the complete unknown. then you absolutely should do. And we got offered a kind of a contract by a brand called Fantasy Football Hub, who make fantasy football content, FPL, in the UK. And they basically said, come and run our YouTube channel. We'll give you X rate per video. We'll cut you in on the ad revenue. And for John and myself, we're both incredibly motivated by like equity and rev share models. We both like that. It's like, don't just pay me a flat fee because you're going to see me check in and check out. And I just don't have that in me. Like I'm, if I put to my mind something, it needs to be really, really good. So if you tell me, okay, here's a stake in that. So when it succeeds, you can win too. Then you're going to get way more out of me. And John's the exact same. So we have that kind of like real synergy in the way we operate. So that was the ticking point where we could basically jump, and it was somewhat justifiable.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering like why you didn't, you know, go look for another broadcaster, like join another agency, like, oh, I've got more to learn. I want to learn from this person, et cetera. But you kind of answered it there. You kind of were chasing that. Like, I mean, I think that's, you know, the beauty and the risk, the joy and the horror of like the creator economy, as it were, right? Where it's like you put your sail in the wind for like all risk, but all upside. And you guys were like, well, we can blow our own wind and make that upside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And like working at Sky was incredible because it gave me like so many learnings that allows me to jump into making YouTube content with all of that education. And I mean, if I'd gone into being a creator at like 20, I'd be where I am now today, but who's to say?
Would have been more
because Sky taught me so much. Yeah, it would have been a tougher journey.
Well, okay, wait. So about you being a creator, because we'll get more into like I guess the like relationship between you and John and other clients later. But I did find that you had your own podcast called Travel Talks from October 2020 until October 2021. Yeah, you did. I listened to like a few snippets, but you did like 45 episodes. Have you done any other like Alex as creator type of things, or was this just like a COVID project? And then you're like, I don't have time for this. Like, yeah, what's the story there?
Yeah, so like, I've always had kind of like a performing arts kind of background. I do like the kind of like the limelight to an extent, but no, that was kind of the real only time I've made content. I did a little bit on YouTube where I was like making really super niche content about the football club I supported, and I thought
that
this could be like a little thing I do. Yeah. I did a bit around that, but it's difficult, right? And I think the true story is that when you want to create content, it's easier to do that when you can kind of instruct someone with what's in my head. So like there's a few elements to it as well. So let's say, for example, you have like John, who's fantastic on camera, like really, really good.
Big character, charming.
And then you have me who's like, meh, he's all right, whatever. So you have those kind of like scales, and then you have me who's like really good off camera. So imagine if you roll reverse, right, and you had like John was editing the videos and I was on camera, the results would not be anywhere near what they are.
Scale would be tipped the wrong way.
But it's because John's because John's so good on camera, and I'd like to think I'm very good off camera. You have this amalgamation where you have just essentially, to simplify it, the two best people for their roles, right?
Yeah.
Because I think like people often like play down like, oh, like anyone can be a creator, but like let's imagine a TV presenter or whatever. Like there are TV presenters who are better than other TV presenters.
Yeah.
So John is essentially the best person for his job, and I back him to the hills.
Well, so the thing here is like my theory on the creator economy, it's like the same with any creative industry, right? And the example you're using for TV is like at the most basic level, there's like three types of people. There's the creative mind, the more business mind, and then like the middle of the Venn diagram where some people are good at both. And like the impression I got from you when I was, you know, reading up, et cetera, is that like you're kind of one of those good at both people where like you have the creative mind and you have the business mind. But like less people have the business mind than have the creative mind, I think, or less people like put effort into it or learn it or want to have it. I think there's more of like a surplus of the creative types and like less people on the business side. I don't know, but you've got both, cause you've got the strategy, et cetera. You also, it seems like, you know, just don't feel like the egotistical need for the limelight as much.
Yeah. No, I'm I'm absolutely happy operating in the kind of shadows. I saw actually, do you know, I'm sure you know Colin Samir. I'm not going to assume you don't know Colin Samir. Yeah. So I saw Samir once saying that like people operate at different types of gratification. So I think I align with a lot of what Samir was saying when he says he loves and values the appreciation of people he respects.
Yeah.
So for example, like I'm not at all bothered what like a random,
you don't need the numbers,
10-year-old who watches one of my videos thinks of me. But if like you've got like Will N E or like Chris MD come to me and say like, I think you're really good at what you do, I'm like, oh wow, that is like, that is worth a million people. Do you know what I mean? That's like, to me, it lands so strong. And I think that's what I kind of strive for, is like the respect of people I value. And I think over the last couple of years working with John and kind of aligning myself so closely, if anyone knows John's story, that in this kind of creative world, they're aware of the fact that I've played a huge role in it. Yeah. So yeah, John is also great at giving me my props. He's not there saying like, it's all me. He's, anytime he talks about our success, it's very much our success.
It's the picture of the two of you with the plaque.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And it's like, we are very much business partners, right? Yeah. I think some people often see like, oh, it's John's channel. But ultimately, like, it's the two of us, and John just happens to be the guy that's on screen.
Yeah. Well, this is actually something I've been curious about. So you've got your agency, Click, and as far as I can tell, it's something you launched with this other guy, another ex-Sky guy, Seb Lissardo, and then he went and did his own thing, this agency Grow, but like you guys still seem to work together, and he still works with you on John. And then I was like, okay, is John a client, or is like, is this like Click is like a business partnership for both of you? Explain to me these different business relationships.
I know, it's quite confusing. So I started Click with the kind of vision of like helping many, many creators. Mm-hmm. But what has happened is that John's kind of,
he's
blown
a full-time
up so fast and that he's, like that's the best place for me to place my energy. It's not ever going to be worthwhile me trying to find another John, because obviously now John's at the point where we can kind of, we're operating at such a higher level that that's the best place to place my time. So Seb essentially joins me with consulting on other YouTubers and brands as kind of like a two-man team. So he's got his own agency, Grow, which is, it works in a similar way. It's like YouTube consultancy, adding an extra strategist to your team, but for a far cheaper price than it would be if you were going to employ them full time. Yeah. But with Click, we essentially work with creators as a pair, right? Because I think, to speak about Seb, he's got so much experience, and he taught me a lot of what I know now when we were at Sky together, because he was my boss for a good few years.
Okay.
And he's incredible at what he does. He's amazing. I always sing his praises, but he has a lot of knowledge that, and I don't perhaps have, and I have a lot of knowledge that he doesn't have. Right, like we work together so expertly well because we let each other speak, we value each other's opinions, and we'll always come to a better result from working together than we would do if we just took on a task individually. So whenever we work with clients that aren't John to consult, we always come to a better result when we're kind of bouncing ideas off each other. But essentially, John and I employ Seb's services as a strategist for our channel.
Okay. And then I noticed on Twitter, like a few months ago, you were posting you were hiring for a long form video editor, I think, to work with John. So do you have like a stable of like editors, designers, like other freelancers, or like who else is it besides you, John, and then like Seb in that contract capacity?
It's my cousin, Jacob, who usually sits over here to the right of me.
Nice.
He is an editor, producer. We're kind of training him up to be like a mini me, basically. Nice. To kind of like take on board all of the kind of learnings I have. And he does a lot of our short form editing. So, and producing as well. So we'll send him on shoots to film. He'll come back and edit, and we'll kind of work together to kind of bring a piece together. But I think a lot of the people would see short form content and they think, oh, it's just clips and it's quick. It's easy.
It takes hours.
We take so much time kind of strategizing over content. Like we've spent weeks working on a short before, and people would think they were smashed together in a day. But there's so much strategy behind it. So yeah, like hours and hours of scripting, yeah, loads of logistics and planning and bringing things together and then shooting it, bringing it back, editing it. And Jacob does a lot of the kind of like heavy lifting on the edits. And like, I kind of like take a more like role, overarching strategy role.
Mm. Yeah. You see, wait, is this the same cousin who you guys raced, you raced John and his cousin to the Emirates, the Etihad to the Emirates video?
It is. He's the cousin that was with me. That's right. In that part.
Yeah. And then Brendy.
Yeah. Well done. Yeah. Wow. Jeez. You've done your research.
It was a good video. I was watching some clips the other day preparing for this and I found that one. I was like, I watched the whole thing. I was like, I can't, this one's really good. I don't know. But I also watched it because you were in it and I was like, oh, I don't think this is a very common occurrence that you're in them. And I think it was like a little earlier in the timeline.
In the chat.
Yeah, I don't know, because this is like a rare you on camera. Was that one, did that one like feel different to produce? Tell me about that video.
Yeah, that was good fun. So yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, we kind of raced from Manchester to the Etihad, and we basically had two VIP tickets to a game that
16
was happening
hours
that evening.
To do it, right? Manchester, London.
Yeah, we had to get there with no money, basically. So we set ourselves the challenge, and it was John and his cousin versus me and my cousin, and we were essentially borrowing and stealing. Well, no stealing, but we were trying any means possible to get down to London. So a lot of kind of like approaching strangers. John has this like ability to do magic tricks, right? So he was just kind of earning money
literally
through that.
With cards.
Jake and I literally, yeah. We would just basically get taking the approach of just asking people really nicely, which was like less effective. But no, it's difficult to produce when you're on camera. And I think that's a really interesting conversation because I've seen it a lot at Sky as well, where people
player
try
control,
and
as it were,
be on camera and then produce as well. And my stance on it is that if you're doing that, it's so much harder to make an objective decision about what's right, because there are so many, there's a myriad of other decisions about the way you look or... Mm-hmm. The way you said a line, or did I come across right? And there's so many different caveats to that, right?
Well, because you're making yourself vulnerable in being within it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it kind of works well with what I do with John, because I'm 99% of the time making that decision. Mm-hmm. And John is so, so good at just accepting the correct decision.
He's genuinely
never once said to me, I don't like that shot because I didn't like the way it looked. Or I didn't like the way it came across. Whereas genuinely, if it was me, I know I would make the wrong decision because I wanted to look better or sound better. And I think I wouldn't be alone in that kind of stance. But John just lets me take that kind of like, well, what's the best? What's going to get us the most views? And he's always happy to kind of have that be the shot we use.
Yeah.
So yeah, when it's me on camera, it's harder. And I mean, I don't need to be on camera, so I'd always rather take someone who has those skills. And I think we've done that with in future videos quite well. People who are very good on camera, and you partner them with John, and John's get more out of John, and you get some nice funny quips from other people. So, and you also have me behind the camera directing the shoot and making sure we've captured everything.
Yeah,
and everything just runs a bit smoother.
So one other video,
the optimal setup.
One other video I want to bring up that is, I think, exemplary of like this like quality of John to just like go through it that you're talking about is the one great title, I Hunted David Beckham, where you guys go to Miami he learns how to make fish and chips at Beckham's like local chippy, right? And then fly to Miami, and then you have to find a kitchen in Miami that will allow you to cook fish and chips in their kitchen. And then that's a whole thing where John keeps going in, getting rejected, and he convinces them to do it. And like, and then I'm kind of thinking like, oh man, like, cause I used to work in kitchens, you know, I had my food handler's card. So I'm like, oh man, he's got to convince them to like, you know, take that risk. And then like, he's trying to get the fish and chips into the stadium. And he like, somebody's like, oh, you can't bring in food here. You have to go to the VIP entrance. And he goes to the VIP and like, you can't bring in food here. But then there's like a guy who you blur out, who's like, I'll put my sunglasses on and turn away. And I thought that it was impressive how he's getting these people to like take a risk in the job that they're doing. And he just keeps going through. He literally says like, I'll turn my charm on. But yeah, I don't know. I guess the question there is just like, when you first started working with John, like, you know, there's so many, he had 5,000 subscribers. There are so many football creators out there in the UK, globally. You know, I consume a lot of football content. Why, like, maybe you've answered a little bit already, but why were you sure, like, oh, this is the guy that I'm going to bet the next, like, year plus of my life on?
I was watching a bit of what John does, I did at the time, and it was to a small niche audience, but it doesn't change the fact that his ability on camera, he just talks to a camera in the way that he would talk to his friend down the pub. Yeah. And it's such a difficult skill, and it's really hard to teach that. You can learn it, and trying to find your voice does happen over time, but equally, he just had it naturally. And
yeah,
it's very impressive. And I think he's also very, very different to what you see in the football space with most creators. He's a bit more sure of himself. He's got that few extra years. So he's not kind of, I don't know, clamoring for fame in the same way that some younger people are.
I think he's both a bit more sure of himself and a bit more willing to be vulnerable. Like, he doesn't flinch. Like, I think of some people who, like, they need to be the center of attention,
yeah,
character, whereas he is more like a vessel for the viewer.
Yes, and it's funny you say that, because he'll always do what's best for the content, but actually, in a lot of our videos until recently, he's actually been, if you were to like break it down, he's been the supporting actor in most of our videos, and it has been, even with the recent video with Mbappe, which has gone huge.
We'll talk about that in a second. Yeah.
John is the supporting actor in that video. Leo is the star of that video. And
he's,
it's all about making his dream come true. Yes. And the fact John's happy to take that role in his own channel shows that he's just wants what's best for the content.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who would want to be like, no, I want to be front and center. I want it to be about me, me, me. And another point, right, is that in football, you get a lot of, when you're a creator, you get invited to a lot of games. You get given chance to meet players, this, that, and the other. And after a while, not just the magic wear off, but you just think, this is better in someone else's hands. Someone else would appreciate this more than me. And I think we quickly realized that, because we were getting the chances to go to games as neutral fans. And we were just like, I have a mate who's an Arsenal fan. He can't get a ticket for love nor money. And I'm at the North London Derby in VIP. What is that about? So we were just like, okay, how can we make content about this? And how can we live vicariously through these people? And seeing people happy and ecstatic is just great content, because they lift you, because you can see what it means to them. So I think a lot of our content strategy now is essentially finding people who would appreciate experiences more than us, but in like super authentic ways.
Yeah. You know, this is funny, because I didn't even think about it necessarily in those ones, where it's the ones where it's like, do this for the VIP ticket, etc. But I had a note down of like how you guys do this altruistic content where it's these like subscriber storms, where it's like, oh, Peter Cech has like a drumming channel. Let's get him to 100K subscribers on YouTube and get them to sign a plaque. And you guys did that with RB Salzburg, I think with Ipswich Town, like all these different teams, people. And I was like, that's a clear content strategy, this altruism that, like, where, again, like, John is just like the vessel through which these things flow. But also, I think, like, strengthens how much people like him and like the subscribers bond with him and like keeps them coming back. Right. But I hadn't even thought about it with like the VIP ticket thing. But that seems to be like, one of the core pillars of your guys' content strategy, altruism.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Like, trying to make people's dreams come true is a huge part of what we do. But yeah, with the kind of subscriber raids, it's very much like, we have this influence, we have this community, how can we use this positively? And I mean, like, giving Peter Cech 100K subs, it's not like you're doing like an amazing good deed. I'm sure he doesn't really care. Well, but I think it's kind of like,
I mean, not necessarily altruism, and like,
but you're kind of using your community and kind of like utilizing them and making everyone feel like they're in a collective and they're doing something that's quite cool. So we've kind of transitioned away from that kind of half and half screen content on short form, but that was really good for us. And I think it just helps build people's affinity to John and make them feel like they're part of his kind of community.
His crew.
Because subscribers as a metric on YouTube is watered down to some extent because of the fact that you don't consume content through your sub box anymore. Yeah. You get served it on your home feed. So the need to subscribe to someone is much lower because you're going to just get served the best content for you. It's so clever.
Well, so okay, wait. Let's talk about subscribers for a second. So you, when you started working with John, I think the story is July 2022. He has 5,000 subscribers. He has no TikTok. And then today, or literally yesterday, I wrote this down. He had 1.7 million on YouTube, 977,000 on TikTok, and 400,000 on Instagram. And what's craziest about this to me is I think at the beginning of this year, you were at like 675,000 or something. You tweeted on January 6th, you tweeted, "Hold me accountable. John Nelis will gain 1 million new subscribers in 2024. He was at 674,000 at the time. So now you've beaten it 3 months ahead of schedule, but you also...
Yeah, cool. That's really cool.
You only hit a million in August, and then now, like 2 months later, not even 2 months later, really, you're at 1.7, and I'm assuming that was the Mbappe video.
No, to be honest. It's been a huge part, but it genuinely, no. We've actually, I don't want to kind of speak too loudly about it, but we've kind of worked it out, right? Like, you can probably see our growth has been pretty rapid, and we've learned so much from doing these kind of like in real life shorts that has taught us about how to gain subscribers.
Okay.
And they've been fantastic for us. So yeah, we've grown exponentially, but it's mainly been through our content strategy to make really strong bespoke shorts that are just way bigger than anyone else would ever think to put any, like, way bigger in resource than anyone else would think to bother. Yeah, so for example, we did a video where we would go to four different Starbucks and ask them to spell a footballer's name. The name would get progressively harder, but the tip that we would offer if they got it correct would be progressively larger. So we went essentially with the idea of kind of giving away a potential 10, 20, 50, 100 quid. But it could have cost us like 180 quid if everyone had got every name right. And loads of people just aren't willing to do that, right? Mm-hmm. And we try to kind of take the approach of like reinvesting our cash so that we're not kind of like just taking the money and running when we do a brand deal. It's very much like, okay, how can we make our content better? How can we level up our content? And we take a lot of learnings from Mr. Beast in the way he operates, in the sense of like, he got a brand deal, for example, where someone said they were going to pay him $7,000 for a brand deal. And he said, make it 10. And it just makes it a better YouTube title. And he said, and they did, and he went out and he made the video, "I gave a homeless man $10,000. Mm-hmm. And that video exploded, and it was a big part of his growth. So we kind of have taken a similar approach. Whilst we haven't got Mr. Beast level money, it's very much like, let's spend our cash on screen and use it to elevate our content. And we're going to iterate off that Starbucks video soon and put up £1,000 if someone gets a name correct, to take the approach of, okay, this is just ludicrous. Like, have you ever seen anyone give away £1,000?
Yeah. What's one of the names?
Jakub Blaszczykowski.
I have no
idea. It's just ridiculous. But no one would, unless you're a football fan.
We
stumbled on a football fan.
Yeah,
Kivior, yeah. That's a good one, actually, to be fair. But so we're going to go up the scale and make them progressively harder, but it's going to be the Starbucks Impossible Edition. But there'll be £1,000 on the line, and all of our content is authentic. So if someone gets it, here's $1,000.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I'm curious more about how you develop these ideas and how you come to them. You mentioned Mr. Beast is like the way, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the way I imagine is like you're looking at what is doing good on YouTube, particularly in other niches, not football. And then it's like, how can we put that in our blender and like put the John football spin on it? And that's basically probably how you get most of your ideas. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So on YouTube, nowadays, YouTube is really, really difficult to be all cards on the table. It's
saturated.
All honest. It's very, very hard to stand out. And also the level of production is just so high. I think back in the day, you could hold a camera, walk around, vlog, and you make a video and it might go and do 1 million views. It's hilarious when you look back on videos that were uploaded 10 years ago, how bad they are and how many views they have.
Yeah.
It's just mind-blowing. And then you have some of these amazing videos nowadays that kind of don't reach their full potential just because of the fact that, like you mentioned, YouTube's incredibly saturated, and perhaps they missed the beat on packaging. And it's just not that clickable, but there's so much competition that you've got to fight against, that it's not good enough unless it's perfect. So, yeah, we use a lot of inspiration from creators, but what I hope is that no one ever can trace where the inspirations come from. Mm-hmm. So if you look back at all of the videos we've ever made, they have an inspiration point. They have proof of concept. We need to know before we make it that there is interest in this kind of idea.
Yeah.
But it's going to be spun in a way that you hopefully can't trace where that's come from.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
So that we remain original.
Well, what about the packaging? Like, I mean, you know, Colin Samir, Mr. Beast, everyone's always saying like none of it matters unless the title and the thumbnail like hit. Is that just like,
yep.
I mean, I don't know, maybe it's a boring answer. Are you just like A-B testing and like your like decade of experience now in like YouTube titles where it's just like, it's just 10 years of experience writing these things?
It's huge. Experience is a huge, huge part of it because whilst I love kind of like analytics and learning, you just, mm-hmm. after a while, you just get a knack for it.
You get the
and
cat.
You just understand what's clickable and yeah, you get a feel for it. A huge part of it is like, can your title fit on one line? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is it easy to digest in a brief glance? Can you understand the concept? How does your thumbnail and title pair together to kind of best portray the concept? Does your thumbnail create enough curiosity so that you want to watch the video? And then pairing with the video, how does the video itself relate to the title and thumbnail, and does it satisfy what the viewer is expecting when they click on the video?
Mm-hmm.
So much nuance to it,
like,
right?
It's not clickbait. Unless you want to make clickbait, you want to provoke, but like it's not clickbait if you actually deliver on the promise within like, you know, a minute of them opening up the video or the essay or whatever it is.
Yeah. 100%. YouTube leaning towards that more so than ever. Viewer satisfaction, which is essentially amalgamation of a few stats, which is like click-through rate, how at what rate once they're presented with the video, do they click on the thumbnail, teamed up with average view duration. So if, for example, you have a video of like, I don't know if you've seen the football niche, like craziest things that's ever happened in football, and it's like a plane crashing into a pitch and like Messi's on fire. It's like, of course, it's an amazing thumbnail, but obviously I'm going to click on that video and that's not going to be in the video.
Yeah.
So like my viewer satisfaction is lower. So I think YouTube is so clever, right? But it's leaning more towards that. It's understanding how the viewer behaves. Did they get the video they expected to receive once they saw your packaging? And packaging is just so important. It's difficult to put a percentage on it, but I would say like it's just as important as the video, if not more. Probably it's
well, okay, so the video itself, so retention strategy and editing, this is something I've seen you say, like whether it was on Twitter or another podcast, that like is obviously something you guys think about a lot and is so important. But then I'm also thinking about Mr. Beast, I think earlier this year, is saying like, oh, you know, moving away from some of that like hyper retention editing and such into like letting things breathe a little bit more. And like, you know, this is a YouTube trend I've heard Colin Samir talking about, et cetera. So what, I'm curious your thoughts on that, this kind of retention editing and like how your strategy for retention in videos.
Yeah. So retention editing, a lot of people think it's like cuts every 2 seconds, super fast paced, boom, sound effects, music. I take more of a stance in terms of, okay, how much is the storyline enjoyable to the viewer? Do they have a grasp of where the story's going? Do they have all the context they need to consume what they're watching? And do they have enough trust in you that what you're going to deliver is worth staying for?
Well, this is like, I think as an example, let's use the Manchester to London video you guys did, where it's like in that there's these two dueling storylines. There's like a couple things at stake where you guys each have like three advantages you can use. It's like, and not that it's like this like hyper fast editing, but it keeps going between these two. And it's like, you're invested in these dual storylines. And like I said, I meant to watch like 5 minutes and move on, but it's like only 16 minutes. But then that 16 minutes is so digestible because it's like, you kind of, your mind is already like thinking of all the beats. It's like, it's literally like on a track, right? It's literally like a percentage thing in your mind where it's like, oh, they're this close, they're this close, they're this close. So it's more of like, I think you said also too that it's less about like necessarily the editing than like the the pre-production planning the story and like making sure that there's stakes at every stage that are understood by the viewer.
100%. Stakes are so important. Like, so with that, for example, you know that we are fighting to kind of receive these tickets. There's a time constraint that's coming down, And also there's budgets and how we're getting on. And John and Brendy might be in the lead, but we're fighting back. So from an editing perspective, I want you to know that Jacob and I, whilst they're in the lead, still have a chance of winning because there's a faster mode of transport that we're saving up to get. So those kind of elements where you go, okay, John and Brendy aren't just going to win, because if they just win and it's so clear after 5 minutes of a 16-minute video, you're off because you know the outcome. So I need to really rehook you at the point where you think John and Brendy have won. I need to make it clear to you that actually, no, we have a really strong chance of winning this. And yeah, that's a good example of like progression in storytelling and making sure that people understand what's at stake, how the story's going and how the characters are kind of progressing towards that final end goal. And obviously the payoff of whoever wins the ticket is the final element of the video.
It's just lingering the whole time. Yeah.
Once we deliver who gets the game, who gets the tickets, we're out. Mm-hmm. Because you've got what you came for. That's what you came for. You came to see who goes to the game.
Yeah. Okay, well, wait. So I want to get out of the nuts and bolts of the video stuff in a second. But one last question on this is like, I'm interested in like how you're working with other collaborators. So like the production that's like not just like, you know, people on the street, and like two kind of things on my mind for this is obviously the Mbappe one. You got access to Mbappe, and I think there's this access journalism side to a lot of what you do. But then another way to talk about that, to talk through that, is there's this partnership with So Rare, which is like this fantasy football product, right? And that seems like they're kind of the main commercial brand partner for what you do with John. So the question is just like how you approach working with like with collaborators, not people in the video, but like you're more like commercial collaborators.
Yeah, so we've been really fortunate because So Rare have been such a big part of what we've done in our journey. They've been with us from the moment we started making content. So we know the team very well. We know the company very well. John knows the product inside out because he plays it and he's an avid player of it. So they value that incredibly highly because it's so difficult to get, right? When you see people creating brand deals, it's very much like, play Clash of Clans, and you know, you can see through it. They don't give a shit about Clash of Clans.
Whereas, works with Erling Haaland in it, yeah.
Yeah, but even then, I'm like, well, he got the bag. Fair play to him. I'm not going to play Clash of Clans because Erling Haaland's put his face to it. Some kids might, but not for me. Whereas John can say with his chest, I've played So Rare for years, and I genuinely love it. So it translates more once he tells you to sign up because you can see he believes in it. But in terms of a brand partner, they're fantastic because not only do they have great access to great ambassadors and athletes, but they just trust us. And I think that carries a lot of weight because a lot of brands, when you work with them, want things to be a certain way and wants you to say this slogan and want to say it in this point of the video and certain things. And of course, they've got their own targets to hit. But we say to brands all the time, if you just trust us, we'll make you the best video. It will do the most views it can. And ultimately, your brand will be seen by as many people as possible. But if you get in the way of the content strategy, you'll kill the video. And as a result, your brand will be seen by less people. Mm-hmm. It's really that simple. Whereas So Rare just get it. And they leave the ball in our court to come up with these ridiculous ideas. And they just back us. And with Mbappe, you've got people from So Rare who are fighting our corner and saying, trust John, he'll make a great video. If you just let him blindfold his friend for 10 hours and reveal it in front of Mbappe. Do you know what I mean? It's a ridiculous thing to ask of,
because only John would do that.
Exactly. And hopefully that's the kind of like expectation from a viewer's perspective that we're building, is that like, that's a really John thing to do and no one else would bother, because it's a lot of effort. It's really, really awkward. It's difficult to make sure that he doesn't actually see and work out where he is. There's so much to it that people don't even see inside a short video. But yeah, that's why we're quite confident that people aren't going to replicate what we do, because of the fact that it's so much easier to
no
just
one else has John.
Take a shortcut.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the idea of like going up to strangers, for example, and like asking them to cancel their flight to instead move on to a flight with us. It's so awkward. And like, not many people have that in them to be able to take on that challenge, whereas John just does, and it makes me confident that people aren't going to replicate what we do.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I was going to ask, I wanted to go back and find like the oldest videos, find the original videos that John was working on. I clicked oldest on the channel. The oldest one's like 10 months old. So I'm curious, like, there's two questions there. Like, what's the logic for deletion? And then were you guys always doing the long form and the short form at the same time? Or was it like short form for like the first 8 months and then long form?
But the logic for deletion is the fact that our catalog of videos at the moment that you see are all very bingeable and they're what we want you to see John as. Whereas keeping up like a live stream or like 10 SoRare players you should buy is just of zero value. It's as simple as saying, like, if you ask me, do you want someone to watch that? I'd just say no.
Well, the question was like, if they watch this, will they watch another one right after?
Yeah, exactly. It's essentially going to, people are not going to be satisfied when they see that video because the video is about players that no longer play for the teams you mentioned. And it's just different content to the style we make today. So yeah, I'm a big fan of just like cleaning up content.
Yeah, wants to sell FC 25. They don't want to sell FIFA 13.
Exactly. So genuinely, if I was working with a FIFA creator, I wouldn't be against nerfing all of their old FIFA videos and just making sure that all the newer ones are there. Because then if you have a smaller catalog, let's say we have like 10, 12 videos, you could quite easily now go through and binge them all. Whereas if we had 160 videos, you wouldn't know which ones to watch. You've got a smaller pool, so you're likely to consume the ones that we presented to you.
That's smart. I want to talk about the business side of things a little bit. So you don't need to tell me exactly how much money you're making, but I am curious how long it took you to replace your full-time salary at Sky, how long it took working with John and doing Click to get back to that, and I'm presuming past that.
Yeah. It's difficult to say, really. There was a lot of times where I wasn't making as much money as I was making at Sky in the early days. But then in content creation, you get peaks and troughs. But in the early days, I was making, some months I would make nowhere near. And I would be like, what am I doing? And John would be as well, because he earned more than I did when he was in air traffic control. So he had a bigger salary to replace. So ultimately, when we had quiet months, it was a case of like, he's probably feeling this more than I do because he's got more bills and he's kind of reliant on that more money. So I was able to, thankfully, my mortgage was very low and it was the right time to make that jump, because if I had a quiet month, it would be okay. But yeah, it took a long time to build it up to the point where I surpassed what I was making at Sky. Maybe about a year, I would say. Yeah. 6 months to a year.
It's not too bad though.
Yeah, it's not too bad.
Is it just you working with John right now? Now I'm just curious, like, the, I guess both your revenue streams, like as this like strategist, and then also John's revenue streams. Like I'm imagining, in like from the outside, it looks like you're just working with John, and then it looks like John is making like AdSense money and then like SoRare money, and that's kind of like what powers this whole operation. Is that accurate?
Pretty accurate, yeah. So we work in equity. So obviously I have a stake in the channel. I have a stake in all the brand deals that come in through the channel. So yeah, AdSense, affiliate marketing, one-off brand deals, brand deal retainers. There are kind of like pillars that operate the business. And then outside of that, I do a bit of consultancy with individuals who will come along with and book like an hour of my time.
Yeah.
And then I have clients on retainers as well that I work with alongside Seb.
Yeah, nice. Okay, and then your day-to-day and how much time you are spending. Like, I'm curious, like, how much time you think you work a week, how many hours per week, and then, like, what a given day looks like in your work life.
Yeah, so I probably, it depends what you classify as work, because like, I'm always just putting out fires into the evening and on the weekend. But like, I'm quite strict. I have an office. I come to the office. I make sure that I get in at, let's say, 9:30, 10. That's the beauty of being self-employed. You don't have like, get in at 9 o'clock. It's very much like, okay, just get in
and do the work.
And I'll leave at like 6 o'clock, maybe 7 o'clock. So I'm kind of working like 8-9 hour days. It's nothing too ludicrous. And I take weekends off as well. But obviously, there are times where we shoot on weekends, and in that instance, I'll maybe work Saturday, Sunday.
Go to Dortmund sometimes.
Yeah, and then I'm very much like, that cannot impede on the weekly work, because that still needs to be done. So I'm very bad at giving myself days off in the week. So there's sometimes where if you actually look at it on a calendar, I might have worked like 10, 12 days in a row.
Yeah. How many videos do you think you have in production with John at any given time? Shorts and longs.
Oh, shorts and longs. We always like to give ourselves at least one video buffer on shorts. And we posting at the moment about like once every 3 days. We're always cooking up videos. Like we have honestly about 60 to 70 ideas that we're kind of not working on, but they're in the back catalog.
Yeah, in the hopper.
And in terms of planning and production stages, we've maybe got like 7. Editing at any one time, we'd maybe have like 5 or 6. And that's just constantly getting topped up. In terms of long form, we have some really, really top ideas that are kind of like ready to go. At any one time, we're really kind of working on 1 or 2 videos. Because at the moment, as you mentioned about the long form editor, I'm editing long form videos and it shouldn't be the way really because I'm doing so much. But at the moment, I'm doing that because we haven't found anyone to kind of take that off me.
Yeah.
And then... In terms of
hard to find somebody who's going to do it to the quality and like commitment to the project as you, right? That's like kind of the thing about being a freelancer, being your own boss.
It's tough to find someone who kind of gets it, and also like I find it hard like handing over tasks because I know that if I'm going to do something, it'll be done to like the best of my ability and exactly as what's in my head. Whereas it will only achieve that if I'm stood with someone really. Like over the edit, and at that point, should I not just
like you
do
can
it
do
myself?
That for like 3 weeks, but then you need them doing it their own.
Yeah, exactly. You need to be have the edit kind of like moving forward without you present. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, why have you got the editor? So we're kind of looking for that person, and we're trying to work out like as we adjust to these new workflows, what tasks people can take off my hands, because then if you free up my time, how can it be best allocated and be better utilized?
Yeah.
Because having me sync footage, for example, isn't the best use of my time.
How can that time be best utilized? Like is the dream here, is the goal like in 5 years, it's like the John Nellis Media Network. Like, I don't know what, like, let's say, cause you had that tweet that I quoted at the beginning, like get to 1 million this year. You got there. What's the goal for a year from now, end of 2025? The dream even.
I always set like big goals. Like that tweet really sums up me as a person. Like I like big, big goals and I like making them public. So everyone's like, oh shit, this guy really backs himself and backs John and backs the operation. Because like, I just know John will be the biggest football creator in the world. Mm-hmm. There are other big people. Like for example, like Celine Depth is like the biggest. She has like 37 million. Mm-hmm. I don't believe John will have more subscribers than her. To be honest, but that her content really lends itself to gaining subscribers from all corners of the globe because it's not at all dependent on language. It means that you basically are watching someone to, let's say, like kick a ball into a goal or name a player and get pushed into a pool or something like that, and it's like anyone from anywhere around the world can watch that, and as a result her subscriber cap
not even is, really about football, it's just about physical comedy.
Yeah, it's her subscriber cap is really, really high, so she'll be the biggest football creator by like subscriber metrics. You've also got Foot Crunch, he's fantastic, like his team are so talented, and I've spoken to them a lot over the years and they've given us loads of advice. They're huge and they'll be huge forever. They're amazing. I just want to be at that table, and I know that we can be. I think I can totally see us getting 10 million subscribers, which to many people would be like totally unachievable. But like, I know that will happen. It's just a matter of time. And it's just a matter of kind of like continuing to learn and evolve and develop your content so that it doesn't stagnate. Maybe 2-3 years, 10 million subs.
2-3 years, 10 million. You heard it here first, folks. Which I think too, it's only getting more popular. Like I only got into it. I'm like an Arsenal fan. I, you know, watch every weekend, etc. I only started watching like after the last World Cup. And then you have people like, I Show Speed, like him getting so into it. And that is having like a knock on effect. Yep. I think it's only getting more popular. To that point, there's this graphic you posted, you guys did the Euros, and there's this graphic you posted afterwards that shows that John's YouTube channel got more views and subscribers during the tournament than ITV Sport, BBC Sport, and England, the England national team, combined. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about how you see that relationship between creators and traditional media, like your ex-employer. Like, I consume a lot of The Athletic's content. How do you see that relationship like now and evolving?
It's difficult because obviously they're the rights holders, so they have the upper hand, and I think that's why I put that tweet out. It's difficult because I obviously used to work at Sky Sports, and it's not to say anything bad about like my former company, but ultimately it is absolutely absurd that someone with zero rights could outperform people who have the rights to that tournament. That's absolutely ridiculous.
It's the rights holders versus the attention holders.
Yeah, and we have more scope to push the reins a little bit. Like, we can be a bit more provocative. We can kind of do things that are going to drive more kind of like attention and controversy. But equally, I think we, because of the fact that we had to learn, like when we both quit our jobs, it just had to work. We've just learned so, so quickly. And in the last 2 years, the amount that we've both come along is more than I came along 8 years at Sky.
Well, wait, so let me interrupt actually for a second. I think this is a good point where, like, yeah, you spent eight years at Sky, but then you left and you've come along quicker and you've got equity in this. And it's like the people who are really good at this and like who can scale an audience really quickly don't want to be at Sky because you've got more opportunity on your own. And there's these other numbers that were going around this summer, Nielsen data for American TV streaming viewing habits. And it was 41.4% of all TV watching was streaming, and 10.25% of that. So 10.4% of all TV watching was YouTube. And so the next biggest percentage number was Netflix at 8.4%. So, you know, the YouTube numbers keep going up. And I think that is a good point that, like, the Skies, the BBCs, whatever, might hold the rights, but like the most talented, most motivated people don't have equity. You're not going to get equity in these massive, decades old companies, right? So I don't know. From where I'm sitting, it looks like people like you, who kind of are mastering the art of like building these audiences, not on the cheap, but on the quick, maybe only do continue to gain more power. But I'm curious then, because somebody still has to hold the rights, and there's like all the legal bits and stuff. So that's not going to change. I don't know.
Yeah. And also, like, when you're Sky Sports, you have to operate a certain way. Your brand has to fit a certain way. You can't break rules. It's very much more formulated. But ultimately, from my experience working at a large company, I didn't have the same level of investment as I do now. And that sounds like an obvious thing to say, but
quite literal.
I really, really, really cared about my job at Sky, because whenever you put me in something, I have to do it to the best of my ability. But equally, when I have a stake in something and I can literally see money coming into our accounts and subscribers growing, and I know that's literally like something I own, I'm going to work harder. Yeah. And I think it sounds obvious, right? But I think that's partly why the fact that creators essentially, I think, are just able to grow and learn, because they just have to find the way, right? And when you find the way and you find the trick and the extra kind of like learnings, you compound those a lot faster than you do when you're at Sky. Because, like, why would I on a Saturday, if I'm not working, be like studying a competitor's video, working out why they managed to retain a viewer for longer during that period? Because I don't have any real benefit to implementing that at a large company. Whereas if I can work out why a competitor's done something and it's worked really well, and then take that and take it into our own content, and it levels our content up, we gain more subscribers, we make more money, that's beneficial to me.
Yeah, simple as. I think that's a good place to end it. What would you like to plug?
Not a lot. I don't have a lot to sell, but just hope you enjoyed listening. I mean, if you want to pay me for a consultation session, then I would never say no. But no, just subscribe to John Ellis and help us hit that 10 million subs mark.
Perfect. Well, this has been the Creator Spotlight Podcast. And listener, I will see you next week.